I'm Harley Schlanger. I have worked for over 50 years with the LaRouche organization. For 20 years, I was Lyndon LaRouche's national spokesman from 1999 until he passed away in 2019. I'm currently the spokesman for the Schiller Institute. And what we're involved in is an international mobilization to break free from the existing paradigm of global cartels, of financial institutions functioning as a global central bank, controlling credit, promoting wars, work with an international peace coalition, which is trying to unify the so-called left and right opposition to this warring gang of neocons. And I write about it and blog about it and have some success in getting the message out.
Harley, tell us a bit about Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche Public Affairs Committee. Some people may have heard of it. There was a lot of, when I was first working online, probably late 1990s, early noughties, there was always stuff going around saying, oh, the Lyndon LaRouche people are crazy, anti-Semitic, and blah, blah, blah. Can you just tell us who Lyndon LaRouche was and what was the LaRouche PAC?
Well, before there was Donald Trump, there was Lyndon LaRouche. And LaRouche was attacked by the very same people who have been attacking Trump. In fact, in the legal case against him that was initiated by Henry Kissinger in 1983, when Ronald Reagan was bringing LaRouche in to negotiate with the Soviet Union on the idea of anti-missile defense systems, Kissinger created a Get LaRouche task force, and it included the lead prosecuting attorney in the case against LaRouche in Boston was none other than the same Robert Mueller who was brought in to prosecute Trump. So it should give you some idea. LaRouche was called left-wing, right-wing, fascist, Nazi, anti-Semite, pro-Soviet, you name it, we were called it. And in England, we wrote a book called Dope Incorporated, which went through the role of the City of London through such institutions as the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank in laundering drug money. And as a result, in England, we were constantly attacked. When LaRouche was asked one time, are you saying the Queen of England runs drugs? He said, well, in effect, she does through the empire. So he was attacked as a crazy man who thinks the Queen is out in Kensington Square selling dime bags.
Fascinating. You just touching there on HSBC and the City of London. Can you go into their role, please? Because I think it's one of those weird, you know, if you go into east of central London, you'll find there is this area which is very quiet at the weekend, very busy during the week. And you've got these big shields with a red cross and a dragon sitting there looking at you as you go into that area. And yeah. I mean, I'm not sure about this, but I've heard that it's almost like a different jurisdiction to the rest of Britain. So what is the role of these massive banks like HSBC and particularly the City of London?
Well, it's, as I understand it, it's incorporated as a city and a government unto itself, which has its own Lord Mayor, its own ruling institutions. And these are directly related to the crown. In fact, when Charles was crowned as king not that long ago, after the official ceremony, he went to the City of London to be crowned as king by the Lord Mayor there. Now, what it represents is the heart of what you might call the empire faction, which includes the corporate cartels in finance, insurance, the people who run the offshore banking networks, the unregulated offshore island banks, and they handle most of the international derivatives trade, which is over $250 billion worth of obligations. It has enormous power through the interlocking corporate cartels because people who serve on the banks, the boards of the banks, also serve on the boards of major corporations, from British Petroleum, the various munitions and military defense contractors, but also raw material concerns and so on. And the MI6 has a, the British Foreign Intelligence has a what you might call a very close relationship with the banks. In fact, a lot of the people who, when they retire from MI6, go to work for various security agencies connected to the City of London. So it's a very powerful piece of real estate because of who's on it. And importantly, in terms of intelligence, this is the center of what's called the Five Eyes, which are the main countries of the British Commonwealth, including the United States, ironically. And the role of the Five Eyes is to coordinate international intelligence and dirty tricks operations. And one of the issues today with Donald Trump coming back to the White House is the fear of the people who run the City of London that Trump may not remain true to the so-called special relationship between the United States intelligence community and the City of London.
You've brought us back to talk about Donald Trump, and we will do that, I promise you. But if you look at the main institutions of the city, you've got the Mansion House, you've got the Guildhall, you've got the traditional British Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister both give their speeches at the tail end of the year, every year there. But the Guildhall is something really archaic, Harley. You've got something like 30 or 40, some are more important than others, of these old medieval guilds. And they seem to have this kind of lingering power from many years ago. There was a BBC interview, an excellent one, with one of the members of one of these guilds who went on the record to say, well, actually, this is supposed to be connected to the trade. I think it was the Lighterman's Guild, something like that, from the old port of London when it was the biggest port in the world up until after around about the time of the Second World War. And he said also it's supposed to be charitable. It's not. They just give money to their friends and say that they're doing charity. So these are peculiar institutions, but they seem to be quite central to the way the city operates.
Well, you have to look at how people get into these guilds and how they get to be leaders in these guilds. And they, in a sense, this is the old boys club. And it does have intersection with the corporate boards of the modern companies, and more importantly, an ongoing relationship with Chatham House, you know, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is the center of British intelligence. And so it's partly, and also through the House of Lords, because the House of Lords has its offices, as I'm told, in the City of London. So this is sort of an area which is a special operations zone, which is central to the, both in terms of its history and the present day, to the establishment of British policy.
These guilds have masters, they have wardens, junior wardens, senior wardens. It all sounds a little bit Masonic.
Well, I think you just put your finger on the question. The Freemasons have a long history in Britain, and it's a history that's steeped in secrecy. You know, it's hard to know exactly what's going on with it, but apparently people who are selected to become members of the various Freemasonic lodges have certain kinds of privileges, and especially those at the top have the leeway to act outside of what is normally acceptable business practices.
Because of the secrecy, it does enable, I think initially the Freemasons were seen as a very positive thing. It was a place where you could speak your mind, a kind of speakeasy, and you weren't going to have the church on your back or anybody else for what you'd said. But we're now in a situation where, you know, you've also got the possibility of criminal gangs operating out of these. A lot of people have been pointing to the Home Office and to the various child prostitution scandals in London, saying, well, basically the police, the Home Office, etc., are supervising and part of some of these gangs. But anyway, look, we're here to talk about Donald Trump, really, and he's invited various people, Liz Truss, Suella Braverman, and basically Nigel Farage, of course, but the sort of right wing of British politics to his inauguration and party. You know, there seems to be a bit of Well, there obviously is a little bit of a difference now between the political flavour in Britain with this, well, you can't even really call them left-wing government. They're certainly globalists. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister now from the Labour Party, he's on the record as saying he prefers the World Economic Forum at Davos, which is going on this week. I bet he's kicking himself that he's got to actually answer questions at Prime Minister's questions today, rather than, and he's jealous of his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who's over in Davos. So how do you see this developing, this relationship between Donald, the newly elected Donald Trump 2.0 and the British government?
Well, it's interesting. I just wrote an article today about what's happening at Davos, and Davos is a representative of the corporate establishment at the highest levels, and its intersection with especially the unelected bureaucrats of the European Union. Now, Starmer, in terms of his policies, is a throwback to the old liberal, so to speak, or left-wing aspect of the empire. But anyone who thinks he's a socialist or that he's out for the people is missing the point. Ever since Tony Blair, Labour has deserted its old historic role as defending the interests of working people. And Blair's Third Way is essentially was set up as a way of creating an alternative cover story for the policies of the empire. And that's clear if you look at what Starmer stands for. Now, compare that with Trump. Trump is, I think, mostly misunderstood what he actually represents. But I think it's clear to say that the Europeans as a whole don't understand the significance of Trump's victory. Trump won because he is a rebel against the establishment. And there may be areas where he goes along with establishment policies, but in general, he's not controlled by them. He's unpredictable. And if you look at what's happening throughout Europe, we're seeing the European establishment being destroyed in elections, just as Joe Biden and the Democrats were destroyed by Trump in the last election. Now, why is that? Well, if you look at Starmer, you look at people like Scholz and Baerbock and his coalition government in Germany, Macron, these are arrogant egotists who think they know better. That's the characteristic of when you're talking about an empire, people who think they know better than the average person. And that they can go ahead and...
Sorry to interrupt you, Harley, but, you know, you look at the politics at the moment in Germany and France, both of them seem to be in political meltdown. You know, you've got all sorts of political crises in both countries where, I mean, and we're having to have a re-election. It's like they're trying to put people into power, but after a while, they're being undermined by the mass of those who have actually been elected by the people. So that you've got an executive, I suppose you'd say, which is they've managed to get the put the executive together. But when you look at all of the both in France and in Germany, all of those specific individual representatives the people voted for, they're undermining those people at the top. So there's instability, a lot of it, both in both France and Germany.
Well, that's my point exactly, that the governments that are ruling for the most part in the West have a set of axioms that they're sticking to that are rejected by the population. But they're being told, the people are being told that they're rejecting it because they don't know enough. They're racist. They're extremists. They're misogynists. That's what was thrown at Trump. That's what's being thrown now at the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. The Le Pen movement in France. Well, why are people voting for them? It's not always because they agree with the policies of Trump or the AfD. It's that they recognize that the existing established parties who have been governing for many, many years are doing things that are against the interests of the people. And the primary one, and this is where the people who deride Trump don't understand him. The primary issue for Trump is the idea of sovereign nations, that governments are formed or should be formed and voted on to elect representatives who will act in the interests of the people. not in the interest of private corporations or private cartels or the banks. But most of these governments seem to think that their constituents are the banks, and if you make the bankers happy, you'll get reelected. That's generally been the case, but that's changing now. You know, I live in Germany, where the coalition government, the three parties are somewhere around 25% support, probably less. And the attempt to put in an establishment party in power around Friedrich Merz and the Christian Democrats is not going so well. So what Trump did was to catalyze a rebellion around the idea of nationalism, a national movement, bringing people together around the interests for a nation. Now, that's hard to do if you can't define what a nation is. But I think this is why you see the problem in Britain and Germany and France. The established parties don't really care what's happening to the population. They ignore the fact that inflation is taking food off the table or keeping people from paying for medical bills. They basically say that this is a change that's underway that's good, like the green policy. The green policy is what's causing deindustrialization in Germany, just as it was in the United States. So here's where you get to the question, the intersection of Davos and these governments. What are they saying are the two most important things to take up at Davos? Sticking to the green agenda, and they're very hostile to what Trump did yesterday when he took the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords, just as he did in 2017. And secondly, keep the war going in Ukraine. And why is that important? Because the establishment in the West is terrified of the alliance developing in Eurasia between Russia, China, India, nations of the global South, and the fear that perhaps Germany or France might be moved to support the BRICS, the Russia-China alliance, and reject the West. And that Trump is not going to coordinate with these globalists, but go in his own direction. So we're seeing a world in tremendous flux right now. And people like Starmer are transitional figures who are going to be gone very quickly, just as Rishi Sunak was.
Yeah, we talked about Kissinger earlier, but I remember him being quoted as saying that he wanted one phone number to call to speak to Europe. He got that with the European Union and in Brussels. In fact, he was at a Bilderberg conference in Dresden in 2016, at the top table, sitting to a certain Ursula von der Leyen. So he got his wish, but he's not with us anymore. Do you think maybe this is sort of wedded to this Kissinger mission, that now Kissinger's passed away, that his dream of having some kind of United States of Europe is crumbling?
Well, you have to look at who Kissinger answered to. And this is something that's interesting, because we were just talking about the City of London. In May 1982, Kissinger was invited to give a major address at Chatham House. And what he said was not covered for many, many years because it was so astounding. He said that when he was Secretary of State under Nixon, he worked on papers from the British Foreign Office and MI6. He said he kept the British better informed than he did his own State Department. And what we in the LaRouche movement have argued is that the State Department in the United States, the Defense Department, and the intelligence services are more loyal to the idea and the policies of the empire, the Anglo-American empire, than they are to the national interests of the United States. And this is when you bring up the question of Kissinger. The other person who was like this, who was considered somewhat the second Kissinger, was Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski took it one step further. He adopted Alfred Mackinder's geopolitical doctrine of making sure that there was no alliance between Central Europe and Eurasia, in particular, keeping Germany and Russia against each other. And that's exactly what Brzezinski intended to do when he launched the so-called Islamic fundamentalist card to use Islamic fundamentalists against Russia and now against everyone. This was a deliberate deployment to keep nations divided, which is what geopolitics is all about. Now, Kissinger, you may remember, his main function was to keep Russia and China apart. And that's why he did a detente to Russia and a detente to China, why he went to visit Mao. And this is today the idea that, Blinken, the Secretary of State under Biden, Blinken's primary concern was separating Russia and China. But the Western policy in Ukraine forced a higher level union between Russia and China against the Western policy, against the expansion of NATO, because NATO is an instrument of this empire. So it's all very interesting to look at this from the standpoint of geopolitics. What you find is that their policies aren't working. The main thing they're saying at Davos is we've got to stick with the green agenda, even though it's collapsing the economies. And we've got to stick with the war in Ukraine, even though it's the populations are turning against it. So they're going to have a big problem. And this is the problem that, Starmer's running up against. If he wants to increase defense spending when the National Health Service is breaking down, when the infrastructure is breaking down, when a growing number of people are having trouble meeting their basic needs, he's going to be gone just as quickly as Sunak was.
So do you think these fundamental policies are deliberate, or is it an accident that we're pursuing policies which are destined to destroy us?
Well, it's deliberate because they're trying to keep control. But the fact is their policies are incompetent. These guys aren't that smart. You know, if you compare Blinken, for example, with Brzezinski, Blinken is a protege of Madeleine Albright, who is a protege of Brzezinski. But each step to the new generation, they're dumber. They're less capable. You know, Blinken is like the traveling salesman who can't sell anything but keeps his shoes shine and thinks he's a really good guy.
You're painting a picture of a sort of empire where the major figures, it's like the fall of Rome, the major figures just put their sycophantic acolytes in charge when they pass on.
That's right. And what you have when you ask about the question of competence, they really believed, and this goes back to the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, but before Schwab there was Kissinger and these guys, they believe that the nation state is a bad thing. Because if you have parliaments or congresses that are responsible or depend on popular support, they'll do things that go against what the ruling class wants. And so what they try to do is have the elections and parliaments as sort of circuses. Well, the real power is in the hands of technocrats over and above governments. That's what the so-called Great Reset was about. This is what Schwab was talking about. This is what Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of Canada, was committed to. This is what the U.S. Federal Reserve is about. Keep the power in the hands of the private banks and the insurance companies and the corporations, and have them have jurisdiction over and above elected representative government, and bring the technocrats in to make the decisions. The problem is that the technocrats are making decisions that are insane, like the idea of getting rid of fossil fuels, nuclear power, shutting off cheap oil and gas from Russia to Europe. That's provoking a collapse of the economies. And it's, in a sense, you hit it right on the head. This is the Roman Empire. These things always collapse because their response, their chains of command and their supply chains depend on things that they have no control over. And eventually they lose that control. You go through a period of chaos and then something better, hopefully, will emerge. I think we're in a period of transition right now between the collapse of the unipolar order and the emergence of a new multipolar order. It's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be a simple thing, but there are many governments now that are breaking with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with France. Look, France has just been kicked out completely of French West Africa. And these are poor countries that are saying, we don't want you anymore. The neo-colonial era, which has gone on for 600 or so years, is over. And the problem is that the people who have been running it haven't come up with an alternative to control it other than war.
Well, there is another thing, and that's the population. Looking at their economic models, they seem to think that AI is going to be running everything, Harley, and the idea of even the consumer society driving the economy, that's going. So they don't need consumers. It's almost like they don't need the population. The population is surplus to requirements these days.
Well, this is the whole secret of eugenics and the idea of population reduction, which has a long history in Britain going back to Parson Malthus. The idea that from the establishment, all you need is enough people to be the servants, and any excess population should die off. And Bertrand Russell, in commenting on this, said war has been ineffective at reducing population, but a good plague every generation or so would allow the elite to prosper. And that is the outlook of these so-called establishment elite, that they're the ones who are necessary. They need a servant class to do the work, but they don't need a large population. And so we're seeing increasingly policies tearing apart the healthcare system, for example. The idea of lowering wages to the point where people can barely survive. Pandemic spread, these things, you know, are predictable. And this is part of the policy. And, you know, Kissinger, going back to him, he once said, history has never been made in the global South. And his policy to the global South was summed up in a 1975 classified document, which called for the Western powers to use food as a weapon to reduce populations in the poorer countries so that the poorer countries don't demand their share of their own resources. That's the modern imperial policy.
Well, that's the policy which may be fading away. But let's get back to the central point, which is London versus Washington. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds to me like Starmer doesn't have too much to worry about. If he's got the City of London on side, and the Brits have got quite a lot of ways to manipulate what goes on in the United States. I mean, particularly through, if you look upon it as an Anglo-Zionist empire, with the Israelis, of course, as well, what you've got is United States is only one of those three nations. And I wonder how you think this is going to play out with the left, so-called left, which is really right, but it's, you know, they call themselves left-wing. they're very much into, as you were talking about, and I was saying, this idea of globalization, the United States of Europe. They would very much like to be part of the EU if that wasn't politically so difficult in Britain now. But what, you know, what, whereabouts do you think are the, going to be the pinch points between Starmer, the Starmer government, or the City of London government, really, because Starmer's kind of just a PR guy for them, and Donald Trump, who really is his own man?
Well, let's take one of the things you brought up, the question of Zionism. This is, some people think that the Jews run the world, that the Zionists are the most powerful force. They were created by the British aristocracy. You know, there was not a movement among Eastern European Jews to move to Palestine. Most of the Eastern European Jews who were threatened in the 19th century with pogroms and other kinds of attacks wanted to go to the United States or Western Europe. It was only after World War II that they were rounded up and sent to Israel. And Israel has served as a kind of hammer against the other nations in Southwest Asia. And this was by design. The Balfour Declaration, even before that, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the secret agreement between Britain and France. So you look at this and you see, where's this power come from? Is it really Jewish money that's so powerful? Well, it's the Zionist movement has infiltrated and taken over many of the leading corporations. The corporate cartels are run by people who are Zionists.
Before you carry on, sorry to interrupt again, but can you make a bit of a distinction here between the sort of political Zionism and religious Zionism, because it's almost as if you've got this major capitalist movement which is pretending to be from the Old Testament, but then that sometimes rubs up against the rabbis.
Well, there's, I would say the real distinction is between Judaism as a religion and Zionism as a political cult. And partly because of the result of the Hitler period and the persecution and murder of Jews, they were able to create out of those Jews who survived a victimization that said, we have to do whatever we have to do to stay alive, that we have a right to attack anyone who attacks us. And so you've created something. I mean, you've seen this happen in the demonstrations around the genocide in Gaza, where Palestinians would demonstrate, whether it's in London or in New York City or in Berlin, and they'd be arrested and charged with anti-Semitism. Now, it's not anti-Semitic to oppose a genocide conducted by settlers who are essentially part of a colonial operation. And there are many Jews who oppose the Zionist policies, but they're used in the same way. And here's an analogy or a parallel for you. The whole question of Ukraine. The main force in the Ukraine revolution, the Maidan coup, were neo-Nazis. But these neo-Nazis were called freedom fighters and have been funded to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Why? Because they're willing to fight against Russia. And so the idea is, how do you bring down Russia? How do you bring down Iran? How do you bring down China? You fund, if you're the establishment, you fund terrorists, you fund neo-Nazis, you fund Zionist extremists from Greater Israel. Now, the problem is made worse in the United States, and you hinted at this, the question of the biblical adherence of some so-called Christian Zionists who believe that the second coming of Jesus depends on support for a Jewish state in Palestine. And so this is a very powerful part of President Trump's support from the Christian Zionist movement. And as a result, I think Trump, who's very good in understanding why we can't have wars, can still be manipulated by that base around supporting Israel, although he's now changed on that. He's now turned against Netanyahu. So you have reality on the one hand, which is that these kinds of extremist movements like Zionism, the so-called Ukrainian nationalism, they're actually a throwback to the violence of the Nazi period. But because they're doing it in service of the empire, they're promoted, they're given good press, and their opponents are attacked. For example, I'm called an information terrorist by Ukraine's Committee to Counter Disinformation. They say I'm an information terrorist who's working for Putin. Now, it's provable that I've never had a penny from Putin. I don't know Putin. I'm not a defender or supporter of Russia's policy overall, but I am against the war that was provoked by NATO. But if you try to find out what's really going on here, you run into the propaganda, which is controlled by the media cartel. So Israel was protected in the West, for the most part, to carry out a genocide, even though people were able to see through social media that they were killing tens of thousands of Palestinian children, supposedly to combat Hamas. So the control of the narrative is one of the key elements. And this goes back to what George Orwell understood, what the British information networks have known for a long time, which is that if you, I think it was Bertrand Russell said, is if you teach people often enough that snow is black, they'll eventually believe it.
Yeah, the getting back to this tug of war between the City of London and the White House, You mentioning Ukraine is an interesting one, isn't it? Because many of us were paying very close attention, particularly those that want to see a better world, want to see less children dying, less young men dying, the end of this kind of meat grinder in Ukraine and the genocide in Gaza. I mean, these are the central conflicts, but listening to Donald Trump in the run-up to the election in 24 last year, it was interesting because he was quite absolutely adamant about the war in Ukraine. That will stop within 24 hours of me becoming president. He's rolling back on that now. But what's happened is the opposite, really, is that the Gaza ceasefire has taken place. He was saying that he wanted to sort that one out too, but he didn't make the same sort of promises. Actually, that has happened, although, of course, the Israelis are using this as an opportunity to send all those soldiers into the West Bank arrest and kill civilians there instead. Anyway, what do you make of this? It almost seems as if you could be right about the British influence, because the Brits seem to be very, very adamant about destroying Russia, that the Ukraine war must be kept going. And maybe they've leveraged a bit with Trump, saying, look, now we'll help you with the ceasefire in Gaza so long as this war with Putin can continue.
Well, this is where you see the problem of understanding of how intelligence is used to manipulate even someone like Trump. You know, Trump 2 days ago said Russia has lost over 1 million soldiers and Ukraine has only lost 600,000. That's a line that comes essentially from NATO, which is not true. The Russian casualties are much fewer than the Ukrainian. But what he's trying to do is to present something which will make it seem as though he's not responsible for losing Ukraine if Ukraine is convinced to surrender. Now, it's very complicated, but the Gaza situation is interesting because everyone thought Trump would do everything he could to protect Netanyahu. But he sent his old friend, Witkoff, a New York billionaire real estate guy, to tell Netanyahu, stop the killing in Gaza. There must be a ceasefire. And immediately, Netanyahu did what he said. Biden could have done that 8 months ago. How many children would still be alive today? So what was the purpose of keeping that war going? Well, this is what the military-industrial complex is all about. Keep the wars going. Keep the fighting going. Keep the money going to the defense sector. This is what they're talking about at Davos. Can we get European budgets to allocate 5% of national income for defense spending, when historically it's been 1.5 to 2% maximum? So we're seeing the effect of the war machine on people like Donald Trump. But I'll tell you what I know about Trump. He does want to make sure that these wars stop. And the problem is, how do you do it when you don't have a unified commitment from the executive branch agencies of the defense sector, the Justice Department, and the intelligence community? That's why he's trying to bring in Kash Patel to be FBI director, because Patel was the leading fighter against the Russiagate hoax against Trump. That's why he wants to bring former Congressman Tulsi Gabbard in to be his director of national intelligence, in particular because Gabbard is fully aware of the role of the British Foreign Office in supporting the opposition to the Syrian government of Assad. So Trump has to clean out some of these networks, some of the swamp networks, the networks in the Defense Department and the intelligence community. And we're trying to help him with that. We did a special dossier called the Liars Bureau, which shows that the people who are attacking Patel and Gabbard and Ratcliffe and others are the ones who have been lying to get the U.S. into these wars. So it's a fight over truth, and I have to tell you, it's a very tough fight because, you know, so many people actually believe that Putin helped Trump win the election in 2016, even though it's been thoroughly disproven and discredited.
Yeah, but you haven't quite answered my question. I just wonder, because Trump has obviously had his 4 years off, and he's very much prepared. He's got all these executive orders. He just sits there and signs them and says a little something for the camera, signs the next one. It's like a conveyor belt, really. He was very much prepared for this moment. And I wonder whether now you're going to start to see the US deep state, you know, the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the British influence, the MI6 influence in the US also start to regroup against Trump. So I'd like you to sort of project into the future, see what you think may happen there.
Well, I think it's already happening. They're doing everything they can to keep his appointees out. They're letting most of them go through. But Gabbard and Patel in particular, they're mobilizing to stop them. Secondly, some of the Republicans in the Congress are rebelling against some of the initiatives that he's taking. But the more important question, and here's how this situation can be moved. Trump did move against Netanyahu in Gaza. He did get on the phone with Xi Jinping and say there's going to be a meeting with China. And so he's pushing back the China hawks. And I think the most important meeting is for him to get together with Putin. Because if they get a chance to talk, I think that's the point at which the situation will start moving much more quickly. The problem right now is that he is running up against these holdovers. I mean, just yesterday he fired some of these permanent bureaucrats. He's got to clean these guys out because they're the ones who shape the environment both inside the institutions and then outside into the public. And that's, I think he is prepared for it, but I think he's also very wary of the backlash he's going to get. Now that brings us to what Starmer's doing. Why send Peter Mandelson as an ambassador to the United States? And you see that Trump is thinking of rejecting that because he knows who Mandelson is. Mandelson is an operative of the Tony Blair networks who has no real interest in what Trump wants to do, but to try and figure out how to manipulate Trump. So if you have someone like the British ambassador teaming up with the New York Times and the U.S. main media to go against what Trump's trying to do, they're going to try to do everything they can to back him off the most important issues for him, which are the opposition to the green policy because he wants to build, and the ending of these wars because he wants to stop the wars. That's where the fight is going to be, and that's where you'll see the role of the Anglo-American intelligence community lining up against Trump.
Interesting. So Mandelson here is known as the Prince of Darkness, certainly yes, amongst older journalists, because he would, if someone wrote a story which was in any way critical of him, and he, of course, was famously sacked twice for corruption when he was a government minister under Tony Blair. Right. And then he was rewarded with being given a job as a European commissioner with another massive pension there. But he used to phone up owners and editors of newspapers and TV channels, etc., to get specific journalists sacked because they'd written something critical of him. How do you think the Prince of Darkness is going to get on in America then?
Well, from what I'm reading in the British press, they think he's going to do an effective job of schmoozing, of trying to ingratiate himself to Trump. You know, you had a former ambassador named Kim Darroch, who was exposed by these emails which were leaked, where he was talking about how Trump is inept and stupid and the Americans are dumb. But what he talked about was the need to have a Trump whisperer, someone who whispered in Trump's ear and manipulated him. And I think I've seen in the British press the question being raised, can Mandelson be a Trump whisperer? Well, I think Trump is somewhat wise to that. That's why he's saying he might not accept the nomination of Mandelson as ambassador. Otherwise, if Trump has been pre-warned and he can't stop the nomination, Mandelson will tend to operate as much as possible to pull together the anti-Trump networks in Washington, even while pretending to be a neutral observer. So I think this is a very clever but transparent attempt to control the narrative. The other person that we're looking at is Jonathan Powell, who was the I think the national security advisor to Blair, now he has the same position with Starmer. And he's supposedly someone who is going to handle the Middle East situation, which again makes me very suspicious because there's nothing that the British establishment wants more than to continue the fighting in the Middle East and the targeting of Iran and the Saudis versus Iran and every group, every tribe, every ethnic and religious group fighting each other. So I think the real question for Mandelson is, will Trump understand that Mandelson's being sent over to be the Trump whisperer, and will he be able to resist the pomp and circumstances of the British
Empire? Will he be able to resist the worm tongue whisperings? I wonder, sure. Look, I mean, this seems to me to be absolutely at the heart of understanding who's in charge, whether it's London or the city or whether it's the White House here, because Mandelson is already on the record as calling Trump a very dangerous man, etc. He's been very insulting to him on his podcast, How to Win an Election. Here, he's a very, very slippery character. I'm sure that the MAGA people will know all about who Mandelson is. So it looks if he manages to survive as this, I mean, the other thing, of course, is he should never be an ambassador. He's not a professional civil servant. He's just a friend of Tony Blair, basically, and a corrupt politician who's looking for to stay in politics, even though the system has kicked him out several times. So I'm sure that the MAGA people in Washington and White House know exactly who Mandelson is. The question is, can he survive in that role?
Well, we're going to make sure they know exactly who he is and that they take up their concerns with Trump. Remember, it's not just Mandelson who is contemptuous of Trump. Starmer accused the United States of going with the snake oil of populism and nationalism. Starmer's been very derogatory towards Trump. And, you know, these kind of things roll off Trump's back, but he doesn't forget it. And I think that Mandelson, if he is accepted, is going to be have a spotlight on him from the MAGA movement and eyes on him from Trump. The question, the deeper question is, can Trump be manipulated around lying briefings about what Putin is up to, what Xi Jinping is up to? Can he be brought into a geopolitical alliance with the empire? And, you know, that's going to be what the fight is about. So Mandelson is one person who's being deployed to do that. In the last time Trump was president, you had John Bolton, you had Elliot Abrams, you had a whole group of these guys, Pompeo, who were manipulating Trump. He sees better now what that is, but I'm not sure he fully understands it. But that's partly our job. I mean, what we're doing with our Executive Intelligence Review, our Liars Bureau dossier, we're trying to make sure that the MAGA people are fully informed that the fight is not what they think it is, that it's a big battle of who controls the global financial community, who controls the trade routes and relations between nations, that's what the fight is really all about. And the personalities are less important, although the fact that Mandelson is known as the Prince of Darkness, certainly I already know that that's grabbed the attention of a lot of the religious followers of Donald Trump.
Well, good. Even though, of course, he's got many connections to the Mossad, so that might be his get-out card. He can try and play that if he wants to. And also, I'm not sure, there may be protests and stuff in New York about the appointment. We shall see. But anyway, let's just wind up by looking at these two. I mean, we've talked quite a lot about the economics of Europe and the power here. But what about these two conflicts? What's your prediction for the Middle East, the Gaza and the West Bank, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and also, of course, Ukraine? What's your crystal ball for those two over the next year?
Well, for Ukraine, I think Trump is serious about cutting off the money. You know, the United States has given over $200 billion to Zelensky and his kleptocrats. And not only is Ukraine losing the war, but there's no prospect for them to win. But who's perched in the background ready to take over when the war ends? BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, they've already gotten from Zelensky the title to the best land and the strategic metals that exist in Ukraine. So if Trump understands that, it would be the right thing for him to do, to agree with Putin to divide, to cut up Ukraine, let the part that's already controlled by Russia stay with Russia, guarantee Ukraine's neutrality, but not in NATO. And I think that's what Keith Kellogg, who's the special emissary to Ukraine, that's what he's talked about. In other words, accept the agreement that was basically reached in March of 2022 that was sabotaged by Boris Johnson on behalf of NATO. So I think Ukraine ultimately will be settled by Trump in a fairly straightforward way once he gets together with Putin, and Zelensky is going to be sidelined very quickly. The Middle East is partly going to depend on what happens with the Israeli people. Are they tired of Netanyahu? Because Netanyahu is committed to keeping the wars going because that's the way he stays out of prison. But the fact that the chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces just resigned yesterday over the concern that he was partly responsible for what happened on October 7th. What about Netanyahu? He obviously wants to continue what is called politely ethnic cleansing, which is to seize all the lands of the Palestinian people, drive them all out, and turn them over to the settlers and to real estate speculators and so on. This is where the real test will be for Trump. If he wants to have a peace agreement known as the Abraham Accords, where Israel is normalized with the Saudis and other countries, you have to do something for the Palestinians. The Saudis are saying now they cannot accept an agreement with Israel that does not include a Palestinian state that has been rebuilt to recover from the atrocities committed by Israel. Is Trump willing to do that? Well, you know, perhaps the Saudis will sweeten it by allowing him to build some buildings in Saudi Arabia and in the newly freed Palestine. So I think there's a way to get to peace there, but I think it's going to depend mostly on whether the people of Israel are tired of going along with a complicity of genocide against the Palestinians. And also that's the case of the United States. The American people know very well that the destruction of the Palestinians was done with the complicity of Biden and Blinken. Will there be accountability for that? If there is, then Trump will probably make the decision to force the Israelis to allow a Palestinian state. But I think we're a long way from that happening. I think Ukraine will be settled long before the Gaza situation.
Well, yeah, if ever the Gaza situation is settled until the end of the world. Anyway, Harley, how do listeners find you, follow you, etc. on socials? And you were talking about your article.
Well, I'll be posting my article probably in a couple of days on the website LaRoucheOrganization.com. That's LaRoucheOrganization.com. organization.com. And when you click on that, you'll see at the top something that says programs. And you click on programs, and the first thing that appears is Harley's daily updates. That includes my articles and my daily 10 to 12 minute video updates, which I just did one this morning on Davos. The other thing, if people want to be in contact with me, I always offer the opportunity to write to me directly at my personal email address, which is Harley, H-A-R-L-E-Y, S-C-H, at gmail.com. And I'm very happy to answer questions or even take on your criticisms. So Harley, S-C-H, at gmail.com.
What about social media?
You know, I'm not so good at that. I there is a Twitter account for me, but I never look at it. The best way to reach me is through the LaRoucheOrganization.com.
All right, Harley Schlanger, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.